A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and honestly, it's the question everyone in Jerusalem is asking right now. Iran launched ballistic missiles at Israel on June 7th. President Trump claims he personally told Netanyahu not to retaliate, says there's a deal in the works with Tehran. But from here, the whole thing feels off. The timing, the choreography, the public statements. Daniel's asking whether we're watching a genuine military crisis or thinly veiled political theater. And I think that's exactly the right question.
Let's start with what actually happened, because the timeline is where the weirdness lives. On Saturday, June 7th, around 10 p.m. local time, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps launched multiple waves of ballistic missiles at Israel's Ramat David Air Base. That's in the north, near Haifa. The IDF says it intercepted all incoming missiles. No casualties were reported. This is the first direct Iranian bombardment since that fragile ceasefire took effect in early April.
What triggered it?
Earlier that same day, Israel struck Beirut's southern suburbs, the Dahiya neighborhood. Lebanon's health ministry says at least two people were killed, 20 wounded. Israel said it was responding to Hezbollah firing at northern Israel. The IRGC statement said the Beirut attack crossed all red lines and that the missile barrage was retaliation.
The sequence is, Israel hits Beirut, Iran launches at Israel, Trump jumps on the phone, or claims to, and tells Netanyahu to stand down, all within hours.
Here's where it gets strange. Trump told Channel 12's Barak Ravid, and I'm quoting, "I'm calling Bibi right now to tell him not to retaliate." He said the Iranian strikes didn't hurt anybody, and if Israel strikes back, quote, "it's just going to keep going like the last 47 years, or the last 3,000 years." That's an extraordinary thing for a sitting American president to say publicly while the sirens are still ringing.
The last 3,000 years. That's not a geopolitical analysis. That's a man who sounds tired of the entire region.
According to Axios, a senior U.S. official said Trump told Netanyahu to hold off because, quote, "we are close to doing something good in terms of a deal." Netanyahu pushed back, but ultimately, and I love this phrase, pseudo-agreed to stand down.
That's diplomatic language for said yes with his mouth, and absolutely not with his intentions. And we know what happened next. By Monday morning, the Israeli Air Force confirmed it struck military targets in western and central Iran. Explosions reported in Isfahan, Tabriz, and Tehran. Iran closed the airspace around Imam Khomeini International Airport.
So Trump tells the world he's restraining Israel, and within a day, Israel is striking three Iranian cities. The leash is not what he's presenting.
Which brings us to the core question. Is this genuine crisis management, or is it a coordinated performance where everyone benefits from looking like they're on the brink of war while actually pursuing their own agendas?
Let's map the incentives, because that's where the theater thesis gets traction. Start with Trump. His approval rating was at 43% in May. Midterms are coming. He's got economic headwinds. The Asian market plunge last week after that AI rally correction didn't help. A managed foreign policy crisis does two things. It distracts from domestic pressure, and it lets him play peacemaker. He tells the Financial Times, and I quote again, "I call the shots. I call all the shots." He doesn't call the shots. He's not talking to the FT about Iran policy. He's talking to voters in Michigan and Pennsylvania.
The "I call the shots" line is doing a lot of work. It's directed at three audiences simultaneously. Domestic voters who want a strong leader. Netanyahu, who's being publicly put in his place. And Tehran, which is being told that any deal goes through Trump personally.
Now look at Netanyahu's incentives. He faces elections later this year. His coalition is fragile. His corruption trial resumes in July. He's got residents along the northern border who've been living under Hezbollah rocket fire for months. Life is paralyzed for thousands of people. And his own military chief says Iran made a grave mistake and was approving plans for the future. If Netanyahu does nothing, he looks weak to his right flank. If he retaliates, he defies Trump and risks escalation. His optimal move is to appear restrained publicly while letting the military do enough to satisfy the domestic audience.
That's the pseudo-agreed in action. He gives Trump the photo op of compliance, and then the IAF does what it was always going to do. Trump gets to say he called the shots. Netanyahu gets to show he still has operational independence. Both claims can be true enough for their respective audiences.
Now layer in Iran's incentives. The Supreme Leader is facing something we don't talk about enough, succession uncertainty. He's in his mid-80s. The protests in Isfahan and Mashhad back in April were significant. The currency is collapsing. Enrichment at 84% is technically weapons grade, but it doesn't feed people. A controlled military escalation that can be blamed on Israel's Beirut strike, which, remember, killed people, unifies the population and gives the regime leverage in whatever back-channel talks are happening.
The IRGC gets to Project Strength. Their statement called the missile attack a warning and said if aggressions are repeated, the responses will be broader and will encompass all American Zionist targets in the region. That's tough language for domestic consumption. But notice what they didn't do. They didn't activate Hezbollah. They didn't launch from Syria. They didn't use the Houthis. For a genuine escalation, leaving your proxies on the bench is statistically anomalous.
This is the key tell. In April 2024, when Iran and Israel exchanged direct strikes for the first time, breaking a 45-year taboo, Iran launched over 300 drones and missiles. 99% were intercepted. It was widely assessed as a choreographed response to Israel's Damascus consulate strike. The 2026 attack follows the same playbook, but with even fewer assets and more advance notice.
How much advance notice?
The strike was communicated roughly 12 hours ahead through Iraqi intermediaries. That's not a surprise attack. That's a scheduled event. You don't telegraph a punch you intend to land.
Unless the telegraphing is the point. The message isn't the missile. The message is the warning. We can reach you. We chose not to cause casualties. Next time, we might not choose that.
That's the performative layer. But here's the counter-argument we have to take seriously. What if this is real? What if Trump's claim of control is a bluff to save face, and Netanyahu simply ignored him? The 2024 precedent showed that the taboo on direct strikes is gone. If Iran calculates that Israel won't absorb even a telegraph strike without responding, and Israel calculates that restraint signals weakness, you get a cascade. The USS Gerald R. Ford Carrier Group was ordered to remain in the Eastern Mediterranean on June 7th. That's a defensive posture, not an offensive one, but it's also a recognition that things could spiral.
The carrier staying put is one of those secondary indicators that matters more than the headlines. Brent crude rose 2% on June 6th, then fell 4% after Trump's statement, settling at $87 a barrel. Markets are pricing in theater, not war. If oil spikes above 95, that's when you start paying attention to a different kind of story.
The market read is genuinely informative. Traders are not sentimental. They looked at the advance warning, the low-value targeting, the absence of proxy involvement, and the immediate diplomatic messaging, and concluded this was a negotiation tactic. The 4% drop after Trump's statement is the market saying, okay, the adult in the room performance is working, back to normal.
There's a fragility here that the market might be underpricing. If this is theater, everyone is playing a role. Trump plays the dealmaker who controls Netanyahu. Netanyahu plays the restrained statesman who still defends the homeland. Khamenei plays the defiant resistance leader who won't be pushed around. But what happens when someone breaks character?
That's where the IRGC warning matters. They said all U.S. bases in the region would be considered legitimate targets if Israel retaliates. Israel did retaliate. Strikes in Isfahan, Tabriz, and Tehran. So by the IRGC's own logic, U.S. bases are now on the table. If a rocket lands on Al Udeid in Qatar or Al Dafra in the UAE, the theater collapses instantly.
The Saudi and Emirati silence is deafening. In 2024, they condemned Iran. That could mean they were briefed in advance and know this is choreographed. Or it could mean they're hedging because they're not sure which way this breaks. Either way, the Abraham Accords framework is being stress-tested in real time. If Israel doesn't retaliate in a way that satisfies its own deterrence doctrine, it signals that U.S. security guarantees are now subject to Trump's personal political calculus rather than treaty obligations.
This connects directly to what Trump told the Financial Times, that Netanyahu won't have any choice but to accept any U.S. negotiated deal. If you're Riyadh or Abu Dhabi, you're reading that and asking, if Trump can publicly override Israel's security decisions, what does that mean for us? The personalization of alliance commitments is a destabilizing force, even if it produces short-term calm.
Let's talk about the nuclear file, because that's the subplot that makes this whole thing consequential. The JCPOA revival talks in Vienna collapsed in March. Iran is enriching at 84%. That's technically weapons grade. The IAEA report from May showed no new inspection access. So when Trump says we are close to doing something good in terms of a deal, what is he actually referring to?
That's the mystery. The Axios report quoted a senior U.S. official using this language, "We are in a moment in time." So why jeopardize a potential deal when you are in the fourth quarter? That's a sports metaphor that suggests they believe a breakthrough is imminent. But there's no public evidence of a framework. Pakistan's interior minister was in Tehran delivering a message from Pakistan's army chief to the supreme leader. Egypt and Qatar are discussing proposed elements of a potential U.S.-Iran agreement. So there's shuttle diplomacy happening, but the substance is opaque.
Iran's position, publicly, is that any deal must include an end to fighting in Lebanon. Israel's ground invasion in southern Lebanon has continued despite the April ceasefire. Hezbollah rejected the deal. More than 3,500 people have been killed in Lebanon since March 2nd. That's not a ceasefire. That's a war with a PR label.
The fragile ceasefire phrase appears in nearly every news report, and it's doing a lot of heavy lifting. It's fragile because the underlying architecture was never stable. Israel's security establishment believes Hezbollah needs to be pushed back from the border. Hezbollah won't disarm voluntarily. Iran won't abandon its primary proxy. So any nuclear deal that doesn't address Lebanon is a deal built on sand.
Yet Trump's public posture is that he's in the fourth quarter in closing. Which brings us back to the theater question. If there is a secret interim agreement being negotiated, something short of a full JCPOA revival, maybe an enrichment cap in exchange for sanctions relief, then the missile strike and the public brinkmanship create political cover. Khamenei can say you responded forcefully to Israeli aggression. Trump can say you restrained Israel and proved American dominance. Netanyahu can say he struck back anyway. Everyone gets to tell their domestic audience they won.
The 2015 JCPOA followed a similar pattern. Obama and Rouhani both faced domestic hardliners who opposed any deal. The public posturing, death to America rallies, congressional letter to Iran, contentious IAEA reports, created space for the actual compromise. The noise was the signal.
There's a difference between 2015 and now. In 2015, both sides had coherent negotiating teams and a multilateral framework. Now, Trump is negotiating via Truth Social and FT interviews. The Iranian parliament speaker said before the strikes that the U.S. blockade and Israeli actions show they only understand the language of power. The two sides appear to be reading from completely different scripts.
That's what makes the fourth quarter framing so jarring. The U.S. thinks it's closing a deal. Iran thinks it's demonstrating that power is the only language that works. Those aren't compatible theories of the negotiation.
Let's pull back and look at what this is doing to the Israeli public, because that's where the theater narrative has its most corrosive effect. A poll from June 7th, conducted right after the attack, showed 62% of Israelis believe the government is hiding the true nature of the attack. Trust in military leadership is at 48%, down from 71% in 2023. The performance might work for international audiences, but the domestic audience is losing faith.
That's the cost of theater. Deterrence depends on credibility. If your own population doesn't believe the official narrative about an attack, what happens when a real one comes? The erosion of trust isn't just a political problem, it's a security problem.
The information environment is making it worse. Iran's state media claims 8 missiles hit their targets. Israel's military spokesperson shows interception footage. Both sides flood Telegram and X with conflicting narratives. Each domestic audience only sees its own version. The truth gap widens, and the space for a shared reality, which is what any durable agreement requires, collapses.
This is the modern crisis management playbook, and it's not unique to the Middle East. Look at the 2022 Russia-Ukraine grain deal. Both sides publicly postured, Russia threatening to withdraw, Ukraine accusing Russia of blockade, while privately negotiating through Turkey. The advanced signaling, the domestic audience management, the multi-channel messaging. The public fight created cover for the private compromise.
The grain deal is a good parallel because it worked until it didn't. Russia pulled out, rejoined, pulled out again. The theater bought time but didn't resolve the underlying conflict. If the Iran-Israel dynamic follows the same pattern, we're watching a performance that manages escalation without ending it.
That's the optimistic scenario. The pessimistic scenario is that someone breaks character. The IRGC has already said U.S. bases are targets if Israel retaliates. Israel did retaliate. If a U.S. service member dies, Trump's political calculus changes overnight. The "I call the shots" narrative becomes a liability. He looks weak if he doesn't respond, reckless if he does.
Netanyahu's hawks are already calling for a stronger response. His defense minister faces pressure from the IDF chief of staff, who said Iran made a grave mistake. The gap between Trump's demand for restraint and Israel's actual strikes on Isfahan, Tabriz, and Tehran suggests Netanyahu calculated that defying Trump publicly was less politically costly than appearing subordinate.
That's the paradox of Trump's approach. By publicly asserting dominance, "I call the shots," he doesn't call the shots. He creates a situation where Netanyahu must demonstrate independence to maintain domestic credibility. The more Trump claims control, the more Netanyahu needs to prove he's not controlled. The theater creates its own reality.
Where does that leave us as observers trying to separate signal from noise? I think there are three practical takeaways here. First, advanced signaling is the tell. When a military escalation is preceded by 12 hours of warning through intermediaries, with no proxy involvement and low-value targeting, it's a negotiation tactic. The signal-to-noise ratio in geopolitical news is inverted. The loudest events are often the least meaningful. The quiet things, back-channel meetings, IAEA reports, carrier group positions, those tell you what's actually happening.
Second, follow the secondary indicators. Carrier group movements, currency markets, oil futures, the Brent crude move, up 2% on the attack, down 4% after Trump's statement, is the market doing the analysis for you. If oil spikes above $95 a barrel, that's the real escalation signal. If it stays range-bound, the smart money is betting on theater.
Third, know which sources to ignore. Truth Social is performance. Iranian State TV is performance. The operational truth lives in IIII inspection reports and Israeli military spokesperson briefings. Those are the least theatrical sources available. And watch for the dog that didn't bark. If Hezbollah stays quiet for another 72 hours, the theater thesis is confirmed. A genuine escalation would have activated the full proxy network.
The Hezbollah silence is the single most important indicator right now. Hezbollah has tens of thousands of rockets pointed at Israel. If Iran were escalating, those rockets would be flying. The fact that they're not tells you everything about what this actually is.
Even with those tools, one question keeps rattling around. If this is theater, what happens when the curtain falls? The actors have committed to roles that may be hard to exit. Netanyahu's coalition partners are already demanding a stronger response. Trump's credibility is staked on a deal that may not exist. Iran's IRGC has made threats that they may feel compelled to honor. The performance only works if everyone stays on script, and scripts have a way of falling apart.
We may be witnessing the birth of a new crisis management norm, public brinkmanship with private off-ramps. The 2024 exchange established the template. This one refines it. But norms only hold until someone breaks character. The next 48 hours will tell us whether we're watching a play or a prelude.
That's the thing about political theater. The audience knows it's theater. The actors know the audience knows. But everyone has to pretend. Because the alternative, acknowledging that missiles are flying as negotiation props, is too destabilizing to name out loud.
Which is why that 62% Israeli poll number is so striking. The audience is starting to say it out loud. They're naming the performance. Once that happens, the theater loses its power. The emperor's stage directions are visible.
When the stage directions are visible, the actors have a choice. Double down on the performance, or step off the stage and deal with the real conflict underneath. So far, everyone is doubling down.
One more layer on the nuclear piece, because I think it's the part that gets the least attention but matters the most. Iran enriching at 84% isn't just a number. The difference between 60%, which is where they were for years, and 84% is the difference between a long dash to a weapon and a short sprint. The IAEA's May report showed no new inspection access, which means the international community is effectively blind. We don't know how much enriched material exists, where it's stored, or whether any has been diverted. When Trump says, "We have a deal working," he's either referencing something substantive that's completely hidden from public view, or he's bluffing. And a bluff on nuclear enrichment is a very dangerous game.
Especially because the audience for the bluff includes Netanyahu, who has spent his entire career saying Israel will never allow Iran to reach nuclear threshold. If Trump is bluffing about a deal to manage the crisis theatrically, and Netanyahu believes the bluff is real, their interests diverge catastrophically. Netanyahu needs the deal to actually constrain Iran's program. Trump needs the deal to look like it exists for about 6 more months.
The fourth quarter language from that Axios source is doing a lot of work. In sports, the fourth quarter ends. The clock runs out. What happens when the administration's self-imposed deadline arrives and there's no deal? Do they extend the clock? Declare victory anyway? Or does the theater collapse and the real shooting start?
That's the structural problem with performative crisis management. It buys time, but it doesn't build anything. The underlying drivers, Iran's nuclear program, Hezbollah's rocket arsenal, Israel's deterrence doctrine, the Abraham Accords' fragility, all remain. The performance just pushes them a few months down the road.
Sometimes pushing things down the road is the least bad option. I want to acknowledge that. If the alternative to theater is a regional war that kills thousands, then theater is preferable. The question is whether the theater is creating space for actual diplomacy or just delaying an inevitable reckoning.
The Pakistan channel is interesting here. Pakistan's interior minister was in Tehran delivering a message from the army chief to the supreme leader. Pakistan has relationships with both Iran and Saudi Arabia, and its army chief is one of the few figures who can talk to both sides. If there's a back channel producing something real, Islamabad might be where it's happening.
Egypt and Qatar are discussing proposed elements of a potential U.S.-Iran agreement. Qatar hosts Hamas's political leadership and has been a mediator in the Gaza negotiations. Egypt borders Gaza and has its own security interests in Sinai. The fact that both are involved suggests the Lebanon peace is central. Any deal with Iran has to address the Northern Front.
Which brings us back to the 3,500 killed in Lebanon since March 2nd. That's not a footnote. That's a war. The April ceasefire was supposed to de-escalate, but Israel's ground invasion continued. Hezbollah rejected the deal, and the body count kept rising. Any nuclear agreement that ignores that reality is negotiating in a parallel universe.
Iran's public position is that Lebanon must be part of any deal. They can't abandon Hezbollah publicly without losing credibility across the entire Shia axis. So the deal Trump claims is close has to square a circle, constrain Iran's nuclear program, address Lebanon, satisfy Israeli security concerns, and give all parties enough political cover to sell it domestically. That's not a fourth quarter negotiation. That's a multi-season arc.
The phrase, thinly veiled political theater, from the prompt is exactly right. But I'd add that the thinness of the veil is the point. It's not designed to fool sophisticated observers. It's designed to give sophisticated observers something to nod along with while the real work happens elsewhere. The missile strike is the cover story. The back channel is the story.
The cover story works because it's just plausible enough. Iran had a genuine grievance. The Beirut strike killed people. Israel has a genuine security concern. Hezbollah rockets have made the north unlivable. Trump has a genuine diplomatic initiative. He wants a deal. So when the missiles fly and the statements go out, no one is lying outright. They're just arranging the truth for different audiences.
The most dangerous moment in any performance is when an actor realizes they're being upstaged. Trump's "I call the shots" line is designed to put him at the center of the frame. But Netanyahu striking Isfahan and Tabriz anyway is a direct challenge to that framing. If Trump doesn't respond to being ignored, he looks weak. If he does respond, say, by withholding military support, he undermines the alliance. The performance has already developed a crack.
The IRGC warning about U.S. bases creates a separate crack. If a rocket lands anywhere near American personnel, the U.S. military has its own institutional imperatives that don't necessarily align with Trump's political calendar. The Pentagon doesn't do theater. It does response protocols.
Here's how I'm watching this over the next few days. 1. Hezbollah activity on the northern border. If it stays quiet, theater confirmed. 2. Oil prices. Above 95, the market is repricing risk. 3. The III Board of Governors meeting next week. If there's suddenly movement on inspections, the deal is real. If not, Trump is bluffing. 4. Carrier group posture. If the Gerald RR Ford moves closer to Iranian waters, the Pentagon is taking the IRGC threat seriously.
Those are solid indicators. I'd add a 5th, watch what Saudi Arabia and the UAE say or don't say. Their silence has been notable. If they issue a statement supporting restraint, they were briefed on the theater. If they condemn Iran, they weren't, and the regional alignment is shifting.
The silence is the loudest signal in the whole episode. Saudi Arabia and the UAE have every incentive to condemn Iranian aggression. They're Sunni powers competing with Shia Iran for regional influence. They've invested in the Abraham Accords framework. Their silence suggests they either know something we don't, or they're waiting to see which way this breaks before committing.
That's the rational actor model. Assume each player is optimizing for their own interests given what they know and what they believe others will do. Saudi Arabia's optimal move in a genuine crisis is to condemn Iran and align with the U.S.-Israel axis. Its optimal move in a theatrical crisis is to stay quiet and avoid being dragged into the performance. The silence tells you which model they're using.
Game theory without the jargon. Everyone's playing chess, and the board is visible if you know where to look.
The board right now shows a lot of pieces in holding patterns. Hezbollah hasn't moved. The Houthis haven't launched. Iraqi militias are quiet. For a crisis that supposedly represents a major Iranian escalation, the proxy network is conspicuously inactive. That's not an accident.
It's the dog that didn't bark, in the most literal sense. Sherlock Holmes would have a field day with this one.
The fun part is that the news coverage is mostly missing this. The headlines are, Iran attacks Israel, and Trump restrains Netanyahu. The fact that the attack was announced in advance, targeted low-value areas, and involved no proxy coordination gets buried in paragraph 8, if it appears at all. The theater works because the media reports the performance, not the stage directions.
To be fair to the media, reporting the stage directions is hard. It requires acknowledging that public statements might be deliberately misleading, that military actions might be symbolic, that the real negotiation is happening in channels you can't see. That's not a news story. That's an intelligence assessment.
Which is why podcasts like this one exist, I suppose. We can say the thing that the straight news report can't easily say, this might not be what it looks like, and here's how to tell.
To answer the prompt directly, is this thinly veiled political theater? Yes, with the caveat that the thinness of the veil is a feature, not a bug. The performance is designed to be seen through by the people who need to see through it. The negotiators, the regional powers, the markets, while giving the domestic audiences in the US, Israel, and Iran a story they can believe. Trump gets to be the peacemaker. Netanyahu gets to be the defender. Khamenei gets to be the resistor. Everyone wins until someone stops playing along.
The someone who stops playing along is usually not a head of state. It's a mid-level commander who didn't get the memo, or a proxy militia that has its own agenda, or an intelligence failure that triggers a real response to a perceived threat. The performance is fragile because the cast is huge and not everyone has read the script.
The next 48 hours will be revealing. If the pattern holds, Hezbollah quiet, oil stable, diplomatic chatter continuing. We're watching a negotiation with special effects. If something breaks, a casualty, a proxy attack, a market spike, we're watching something else entirely. Either way, the tools for distinguishing signal from noise are the same. Look at what they do, not what they say. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1927, a Bhutanese monk named Thinley Gyatso recorded what he described as a small sun rising from the northern crater of the moon, one of only 3 documented transient lunar phenomena reports from the Himalayan region during the interwar period. His observation was considered a case of high-altitude atmospheric distortion until 2019, when Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter data revealed a previously unmapped fault line exactly where he'd been looking.
A Bhutanese monk spotting lunar geology decades before NASA confirmed it. That is impressive.
Hilbert, I have no idea how you find these things, but please never stop.
One open question before we wrap. If this is theater, and the curtain eventually falls, what's left? The nuclear program hasn't stopped. Hezbollah hasn't disarmed. The Abraham Accords are still fragile. The performance buys time, but time for what? That's the question that matters, and nobody's answering it.
We may look back at this week as the moment a new Middle East crisis management template was locked in. Or we may look back at it as the moment the template collapsed. We'll know soon enough.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop, for keeping the show running, and for that remarkable fun fact. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to understand the signals behind the headlines, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, or find us at myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back next week. Until then, watch what they do, not what they say.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.